Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the United Nations has said that Yemen is the most pressing humanitarian crisis in the world. This is the Saudi regime, along with its regional allies, and support from some Western countries continue to bombard the poorest country in the region. Yemeni blood is on the hands of many, but what will be done about it, and how can the suffering be stopped?
The humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been exacerbated by the incessant war and siege over the past 6 years. The executive director of the World Food Programme, David Beasley, confirmed that the number of people facing the second highest level of food insecurity will increase from 3.6 million to 5 million in the first half of 2021.
There is indeed a humanitarian catastrophe, and if aid arrives, it goes to other places, and 70% of it goes to United Nations organizations to cover operational expenses. The other side must stop the blockade completely, because it affects Yemen in the medical, educational, and food sectors. So we think the focus should be on the root cause of the problem, which is the siege on Yemeni people.
Beasley called on the international community not to abandon the millions of families who are in severe need of aid. Millions of people are on the brink of a new famine as the UN's Yemen response faces historic shortfalls. $1.5 billion is what the donor governments contributed, while the UN says it needs $3.2 billion to avert the crisis.
Those who provide aid, such as the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and America, have failed and did not abide by their pledges they made. They spent more than these sums to buy weapons, but they do not help Yemenis as they claim, which confirms the authenticity of the United Nations reports that famine is on the rise in Yemen.
The coronavirus pandemic, along with the funding crunch, has forced dozens of aid agencies and organizations working in Yemen to scale back their assistance. Some of them even had to give up their programs entirely, which has deteriorated the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. Famine can still be prevented if the international community wakes up to take serious action to save the lives of millions in Yemen, including women and the children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Hossein Al-Bakhati, Yemeni activist and political commentator out of Sana'a, and Eli Joseph James, a radio host and political commentator out of Chicago. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in Sana'a. Hossein, we've been hearing about the devastating effects of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen for years now, especially regarding children and starvation. Is the international community unable to stop this, or is it choosing not to address this, and why, if that's the case?
Of course, the international community, they can stop this aggression against Yemen and war and blockade and constant Saudi attack on Yemen main infrastructure by actually pinpointing who is the one responsible for this war on Yemen. We remember that in all UN statement or UN envoy to Yemen, either the British one or Mr. Griffith, they haven't actually mentioned Saudi Arabia as a part of this war, or United Arab Emirates, or all the countries that supported this war, like United States, France, and the UK. They call it as a civil war, and this actually they want to deceive and mislead the international media, and to deceive as well the international community, because when there are 17 countries involved in this war, they force blockade on Yemen. If you call it a civil war, this means that you actually not taking the responsibility from Saudi Arabia and other countries. And as well, we remember that United Nations actually has appointed Saudi as a member of the Human Rights Council in Geneva during the war in Yemen, and they have removed Saudi Arabia twice from a list for killing children, because as the UN Security General at that time, I believe was Ban Ki-moon, he said because of pressure from Saudi Arabia that they will cut all the aid to the United Nations if the United Nations will not take Saudi name. This means that for Saudi Arabia, this is a green light that they can continue their war against Yemen. They can continue the blockade. As you mentioned in your report, the World Food Program, they said 5 million people in the coming month will actually have food insecurity. There are 17 million, according to United Nations Agency and some NGOs, that 17 million Yemenis are in urgent need of aid. And with all that, with the coronavirus and the blockade, I believe, and it's clearly, as the United Nations have said before, is one of the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. But still, they are not saying who is behind this, because before we haven't had any of this illness or this food insecurity.
Well, let me cross over to Eli in Chicago. Now, for more than 3 years, Saudi Arabia has implemented that illegal blockade that our other guests have been talking about on Yemen, blocking roads, ports, and air traffic, making getting in basic necessities very difficult. So all of these things are man-made. Where's the outcry and where's the pressure on changing this reality in order to at least get the basic necessities to these individuals? Millions and millions of people are on the verge of starvation.
Well, there is none. There should be, worldwide, there should be an outcry, but all you get is a posturing, hand-wringing from the politicians of virtually every country except from those countries that are most affected. This is, to me, an exact repeat of what the Israelis have been doing to the Palestinian people for, since 1945 and even before, that the outcry is controlled by the mass media of the international corporations, which have no real interest in the suffering and the well-being of the affected peoples. But what they do are interested in is maintaining supply of arms, the supply of materials to the people that they do business with. And apparently the Yemen people are not sufficiently good customers for the international community for them to be concerned about. This is a humanitarian crisis that reeks to high heaven and also down to hell, because the United Nations could be doing something, but they're not. Now, my understanding is that this began in 2015 when a Saudi-led coalition began bombing Houthi rebels who had forced Yemen's president Hadi into exile. So as far as I'm concerned, this started out as a civil war, your other guests could correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the Saudis have no business getting involved in internal affairs of Yemen. That's my position on this.
Well, on the one hand, UN continually warns about the danger of the situation in Yemen. On the other hand, UN member countries, even some of those on the Security Council, continue to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, the regime mainly responsible for the onslaught on Yemen with, of course, other regional countries. So then what does that mean? Can the UN be counted on or cannot? And on the other hand, how can we expect these countries to help then improve the situation in Yemen?
I think the involvement of this country like United Kingdom, France, and especially the United States is one of the main goal of the start of this war. We've seen that it's not all about bringing Hadi or as they call the legitimate government to Yemen. We've seen that what the United Arab Emirates is doing in south of Yemen. They have created militia and group. They have made ties with Al-Qaeda and ISIS to fight Sana'a or to fight Ansar al-Houthi. And those groups actually do not recognize Hadi government, and they have fought several times in the south. And that's one of the main goals of the war, to control and secure the shipping line in Bab el-Mandeb and in Socotra Island. And the other goal is to sell more weapons to Saudi Arabia. Those three Western countries actually are making billions of dollars in profit from this war. According to the Independent, they think about 1 year or 2 years ago, they said the United Kingdom has increased its sales of weapons to 500%. And as well, during Obama administration, the war started on Yemen with the green light from the United States. And they have sold the highest rate of weapons to Saudi Arabia in the history of the United States. That's why I think if this country actually still making profit, they are not gonna stop this war. They will continue using the United Nations and the UN Security Council to only actually blame Sana'a as
so
every
Hussein,
time
let
Sana'a
me just jump in here.
Any military
so Hussein,
installation.
Let, Hussein, let me just jump in here.
Yeah.
So are you saying, for example, that the United States support for the Saudis in this onslaught against the Yemenis, it's all economic? Is it because of the billions of money that Washington gets and London gets from selling weapons? Is that the only reason that they are supporting the Saudis in this onslaught? Or tell me about what you think of on that side of things.
Yes, this is one of the main reason, and the other reason is, as I mentioned, is to control and secure the Bab el-Mandab Strait, is one of the most important shipping line in the world, and Socotra Island, it's situated in one important area south of Yemen, and to control ports and airports, especially in Aden and El Mahra, and this actually gives the United States and the Zionist state a foot or a present in those area, because when the revolution in Yemen has took place in 21st of September 2014, the United States didn't like that, because here Houthi and as well the government here now in Sana'a are anti-United States foreign policy, and as well they are against the occupation of Palestine and against the Zionist state of Israel. All that actually is what has actually given the green light to Saudi Arabia to impose and to start this war. And I just want to add one thing. We've seen many times lately in the media that if Biden will come into power, maybe he will stop the war, because he has made many, many promises during his campaign. But I think this is a big lie, because the United States have the same policy. It doesn't matter who is in control of the White House, but at least actually Trump, he was honest with all his promise during his campaign. He has actually implemented those promises. But Biden, I'm sure that he will continue selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And the war started during Obama, who was given the Nobel Peace Prize during his administration. This actually shows the goal is economic goal to sell more weapons, and as well to secure and to control Yemen, because the strategic place where Yemen lies is actually given an interest for the United States and other countries.
Well, Eli, according to the UN, at least half of the country of Yemen is on the brink of starvation, as I said earlier, this due to man-made causes. Your take on this tragedy, and what can be done in order to change this around?
Well, the UN strategy is very much the same as Israeli strategy, because the Rothschild banking family created the United Nations and created the Israeli state shortly after creating the United Nations. So whatever happens in the Middle East is essentially the policy of the banking firm of Rothschild and Company, who essentially control all banking operations in the entire world, with the exception of some Muslim countries. They even control the economic operations of communist countries. So the overall strategy in the Middle East of the Rothschilds is to destabilize every single country within the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, including Iraq, Iran, what have you. Everything that the Israelis claim for themselves under their false claim that they are the people who have been donated by God, that whole area from the Tigris-Euphrates all the way to the River of Egypt. But that's false. They are not the people to whom God donated that territory to. That false claim is what created the Zionist state. So ever since they created the Zionist state, they have been using this tactic of pitting one Middle East country against the other. And in fact, Iran has become the new Nazis of the world. Once they got done with Nazi Germany, now they blame everything on Iran. That's why they don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. They don't want Iran to have anything. They want to destroy your country just like they destroyed Germany. And they're using constant chaos in the Middle East, pitting one Arab nation against another Arab nation, against your nation, against et cetera, et cetera. This is all that they're doing, and the United Nations is not going to end it, because the United Nations are mere puppets of the Rothschilds. Over to you.
All right. Well, Hussein, the Yemeni people have fought back as best they could against the blockade on its country and the all-out war being waged against them by the Saudis and Emiratis. Now, this was a war that Riyadh said would be over in weeks, and now it has been more than 5 years. What happened? How could Riyadh miscalculate to this degree?
Actually, they miscalculated. They might have done this actually on purpose, because at the beginning of the war, they blamed Iran for, as they say, sending all these weapons to Sana'a forces. And after 3 weeks of blockade and constant bombardment, we've seen that the spokesperson of the coalition, the previous one, Mr. Al-Asiri, he said that they have destroyed 85% to 90% of the capacity of weapons that Sana'a forces has. But after that, it clearly was actually the opposite. And this actually proves that there is no weapons coming from Iran, because this blockade, who's responsible for not allowing for food and medicine to come to Yemen, all ships that arrive to Yemen are searched by the United Nations, are searched by Saudi Arabia, by the coalition, by American forces in the region. So how can Iran smuggle weapons? That's why the miscalculation started from that. But Saudi Arabia used this excuse just to get an attention from countries like United States and the United Kingdom and others, to get the full support, because they want the international community to believe that there is a real present for Iran in Yemen. But to be honest with you, there is no present. Yemen has a huge amount of weapons. They had about 600 ballistic missiles. They have developed new weapons like drones and cruise missiles. And according to the army spokesperson here in Sana'a, he said yesterday that Saudi Arabia are in the final stage of losing this war, and the Yemenis actually has not started to attack and target like airport in Najran and Jizan and Asir, south of Saudi Arabia, only because Saudi Arabia is keeping targeting Sana'a airport and other airports and keeping this blockade. And I just want to mention that I expect in the coming days or weeks that Saudi will continue to target Sana'a airport, because we have seen in their media in the last 72 hours that they claim that Sana'a airport is used as a weapons base for the Sana'a forces. And this is actually so silly, because you Sana'a forces will leave all the country, will leave all the mountains they have, all the hills, all this huge empty space to use the Sana'a International Airport. But because this airport is the last lifeline for Yemenis, and actually the exclusive client for this airport is the United Nations, but they haven't said anything when Saudi have targeted the airport on last Friday. That's why I believe Saudi now want to close this airport totally, even for the United Nations. But I believe if this will be done, then the Yemeni forces will take a huge step, and they will target Saudi Arabia main infrastructure, and they will target like a large airport either in Jeddah or in Abu Dhabi or Dubai or Riyadh, because they always say after any attack that if Saudi will stop and lift the blockade, we will stop. So the one responsible for the war to continue is Saudi Arabia and okay. All the country behind it.
Well, Eli, what is the goal of Saudi Arabia now with this onslaught and blockade continuing? Does Riyadh just want to starve and torture the Yemeni nation to death?
It appears that way, but the reality is, here in the West, those of us who are savvy to the Zionist occupation of the entire Middle East and the Zionist occupation of virtually the entire world, is that they need to make boogeymen, a boogeyman. So they've made a boogeyman of Yemen, and they have no consideration, concern, they have no humanitarian concern whatsoever for the people of Yemen. And as long as the people of Yemen are caught in the middle of this game where the nation of Saudi Arabia is being dangled by the Israeli puppeteer to do the bidding of the Israelis, because as your guest pointed out, they have all these strategic operations going on that the Israelis want, number one, the Israelis want to destabilize the Middle East for their own purposes, and they create strife among different Muslim groups to fight amongst themselves. They created the Wahhabi sect. The Rothschilds actually created the Wahhabi sect. I don't know if your listeners are aware of that. And they have been using the Wahhabi sect, and Saudis were instrumental in supporting the Wahhabis against other Islamic religions.
Okay.
So this has been ongoing for, well, several hundred years. several hundred years. Back to you.
Hossein, 1 minute. What is it going to take to bring this onslaught on Yemen to an end?
I think the only, just that Saudi Arabia and United States and other countries back in Saudi Arabia, they only recognize the power and the one who is strong in this war. And I think if the Yemeni army will keep targeting Saudi main infrastructure, especially the oil field, this is where it actually hit and hurt Saudi Arabia, because they depend 100% on oil to buy all these weapons and as well to buy the United Nations and United States and all that. So if they do that, they can as well hurt the economy of the United States and UK and other countries. And I believe if they continue this type of attack, if they can actually stop Saudi from exporting oil, I believe that this war gonna end. And we remember just about maybe 1 week ago, after the attack on Aramco in Jeddah, United Kingdom has sent some troops to Saudi Arabia, as they say, to protect the power and the oil field in Saudi Arabia. This means those targets actually gonna hurt those countries who selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And okay, this decision actually should be taken by Sana'a, and they have as well responsibility to do so.
All right, thank you so much, both of you, for being with us on this debate. Out of Sana'a, Hossein Al-Bakhati, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Out of Chicago, Eli Joseph James, radio host and political commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-aliyyil azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafsa ammara, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers of the Rusul, who were given the book and mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لقد أرسلنا رسلنا بالبينات وأنزلنا معهم الكتاب والميزان ليقوم الناس بالقسط.
One of the beautiful verses of the Quran about this ummah which is going to be established, this community which is going to be established, is this ayah, Surah Baqarah, verse 143. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. وَكَذَٰلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا. This verse is preceded and followed by some sentences about the change of qibla, direction of prayer. You know that Muslims initially were asked to say their prayer towards Baytul Muqaddas or Baytul Maqdis or Jerusalem. This was a sign of unity, a sign of saying that we should be praying towards the same direction. But this was not well received. Unfortunately, instead of appreciating this, they started saying that Muslims don't have Qibla of their own. They need us. They imitate us. Anyway, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala changed the direction. Of course, we believe that in the knowledge of Allah, this was from the eternity known. But that was a test to see who is going to accept and who is going to reject. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَكَذَٰلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا لَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ. This ayah is very important. We have made you in this way a middle, a balanced nation. Islamic community, Muslim ummah, has to be balanced, has to find the middle position. Going to extremes has nothing to do with Islam and with the way that Allah has planned this religion. وَكَذَٰلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers, open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Of course, this Jal is Tashri'i, not Takwini. It means that this is legislative. It's not that Allah has created us to be balanced so that we cannot be anything else. This is the legislation of Allah. Allah has wanted us to be balanced. Allah has designed Islam in the way that we can be balanced. But if we misunderstand Islam or mispractice, then we end up with the situation that we have in the world today. That you see lots of problems and lack of balance, as I will mention, in Muslim ummah. And if the ummah is like what we see today, they don't represent Islam. At least parts of this ummah, they don't represent Islam. Because Allah has planned and designed this ummah In other words, he has wanted this ummah to be balanced. Why? Is it only for their own good? If you are not balanced, you would suffer. You know, if I eat too much, or if I eat nothing, I will suffer. If I don't work, or I work too much, I will suffer. If I pay no attention to my family, or I pay too much attention and I forget everything else, I will suffer. But here there is another factor, another thing. If our ummah is not balanced, not only we suffer, we would also lose an opportunity. What is that opportunity? That is the opportunity of being leader for other nations.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillah rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organisation says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population 5 times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame-shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A number of ambassadors and military attachés of different countries in Taiwan have signed a memorial book to commemorate the high status of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top Iranian scientist who was assassinated on November 27th. The diplomats have voiced their hatred and condemnation against this act of terror.
Right after the assassination, Russia has strongly condemned the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and believes that the main goal of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absert, east of the capital Taiwan. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote a once peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt a once peaceful nuclear program.
The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, where the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is too low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. the existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting and help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering. Faisal al-Mikdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit by before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the president to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna, a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leadership in Nigeria, in general, and in northern Nigeria in particular, to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing Northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers.
Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened. And now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes you proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly. Like, the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines. Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit. Lockdowns and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community. Then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli or, for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say